From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in celebrated Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development.
I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy, I too make nice games. For this week's episode, our topics are parasocial relationships and narrative pacing. And so, everyone is ready. Let's start.
That was pretty good pacing. It wasn't a narrative, but it was
good. Okay, pacing. I'm cutting this off right now.
Cool.
Nope, we're not doing it.
Okay. First order of business. Yeah. Ellen, you're all better.
I am mostly better. Yeah, well, I tested negative for COVID, and it's been, you know, the required several freaking days that the CDC suggests that you lock yourself up.
It's been about 2 weeks since your symptoms started.
Has it been 2 weeks or has it been like 18 years? I made it all the way to this point in the pandemic without getting sick. And I am glad that I have vaccines and boosters because that was rough.
Yeah.
Would not recommend.
0 out of 10.
0 out of 10. I still have some lingering symptoms, but I think it's because I, you know, when I was sick, I also was then, you know, my immune system was busy.
Right.
So other stuff like snuck in on the side. So I think I'm battling that. But it's from what I've heard from other people who've had COVID around the same time, it takes like a month to completely.
Right. It's there are things that stay with you, but you're free to move about the cabin now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I can come back into the clubhouse, which is the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I get to see you guys in person.
Yeah.
Yay. And I watered my plant. Stephen watered the plant for me last week.
Yeah.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks. I forgot and then remembered, but I did do it. So
exactly. That's what counts.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
The plant doesn't care as long as it doesn't die.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I feel like I would care if I was a plant, but
you're not a plant.
Exactly.
You're so much more than a plant.
It's true. One would consider me human. Serious Games Conference is happening this week. Yes.
Yeah, that's a thing that is happening this week.
Okay. When you say this week, do you mean the week we're recording or the week this episode comes out?
The week that we are recording.
Okay, so that's about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. For listeners, 2 weeks ago, and I will see how many sessions I can attend live in person. I volunteered to help out again this year. I think I'll be doing some video editing like I did last year. And there were some pretty cool sessions. So hopefully I can get some recordings and get to some of them live and get some good ideas that we'll talk about on the show.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah. And if you want to hear more of Ellen talking about it, last year you went over it a little bit. So you can just search the website.
Yeah. Mark made a whole thing.
But it's not just that. There's lots of events going around. It's like the summer game news season.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, we're not going to go through all the like news because we're not that kind of program. But like E3 didn't happen this year. It's supposed to happen again next year.
Mm.
Who knows?
Yeah.
But a bunch of other things happened instead. It's still kind of like, you know, June press release.
Yeah, like everybody has their own directs now.
Yeah. Not Nintendo yet. Although by the time you hear this, listener, they may have announced one.
I think there's rumors that it's supposed to be at the end of the month.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We'll see.
But a couple things that folks within our near our circle were involved in during, I think it was the Wholesome Direct, maybe I'm wrong, where Lumberjack was given a surprise release. That's out now that our friend from Armor Games, August Brown, was a producer on that for the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
It was really excited to see that get out.
That's cool.
It's a very cute, fun game.
Yeah, it looks super cute.
Being a bear and destroying totems of industry.
It's like my career goal.
Yeah. other thing is Steam Next Fest. Again, these are all things that happened 2 weeks ago for you listeners. Mm. Steam Next Fest is, I actually don't know how long it goes, but it's just another one of those Steam's pretend holidays. They have so many of them now. its focus is on a bunch of demos. And so if you're a Steam user, if you're part of that social network, there's like rewards for, you know, and incentives to play a lot of these demos. The game I'm working on has a sort of a side spin-off that I'm not working on, but I'm seeing developing, which is really fun, called Slayer's X, Terminal Aftermath, Vengeance of the Slayer, spelt wrong on purpose.
Oh, that's great.
It's like a Doom or Duke Nukem style, old, you know, boomer shooter, right?
Yeah.
That it was created by a character from Hypnospace. Mm. So it's got an extra level of meta to it. And but is it, you know, that takes place in 1999. This game, the conceit is that the character Zane was working on this game and then lost everything, like under a couch or something. Wow. And then 20 years later, he's 37 years old and he works at like a dollar store and he found the old code and then finished it up.
Oh, that's
and then
cool.
released it.
Yeah.
But it all takes place like he's Jay Tholen, who is the creator of Hypnospace and this game, he created a Twitter account for this character and it's just in character promoting it.
Amazing. Yeah.
And it's really incredible because when people say things like that are part of our real world, he'll act like it's like the Westworld robots. He like won't know that it's happening.
Oh.
Where like I've never heard of that. And and so just the commitment to the character is really cool. And
yeah.
That game has a demo that's out as part of Next Fest, and that came out today as we're recording. The response has been pretty good, which is really exciting because that will actually hype up the, you know,
yeah.
keeping that universe in people's minds will help when it's time for Dream Settler to have a demo or a beta,
awesome.
Which fingers crossed shouldn't be too long from now. It will be a while from now, not too long from now. Mark,
what date is it? Okay. All right.
Mark, it's on the calendar. Yeah.
Noted, this is when Mark said.
Yeah.
I made a lot of progress on the page builder this week, which
yeah.
is Hypnospace. You know, you could has a separate program where you can mod and make your own fake internet pages, and we want to make that part of the core gameplay this time around. This isn't a reveal or anything. People, you know this. We've talked about this before, but I'm leading that part of the development, and so I'm kind of just I took a break from making the game to make this like Microsoft front page utility essentially, and it's interesting. So I had a lot of progress this week. So it's kind of been a I'm very high on the project at the moment. There's ups and downs when you're working on these things. Like,
for sure.
I'm in an up phase right now.
That's good.
It's pretty cool. And then seeing all this stuff about Slayer's X being like, you know, getting its demo and being in the Discord and playing some of the pre-release demo builds and providing some feedback and just seeing that happen. It's been nice because I don't have anything to do with that game.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of just to sit around on the sidelines and watch it get the reception it's been getting.
Yeah. It's still your team though. You know?
Yeah. It's like, exactly what it is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. In our Circle news.
Yes.
Origins, big tabletop convention, and GDEX, big video game convention, happening at the same time in Ohio. And our pal Max, who's the guest booker for this program, had his game, Read the Robotanist, there, showing it off on the floor.
Yeah.
And what happened?
Oh, I won an award.
Yeah.
Like a huge award, too. Like it was big, right?
Yeah, it was. It's got a whole, like, plaque and it's shiny.
I know it's so fancy.
I think
yeah.
it had a box.
It for people who need to imagine, it looks like a Cable Ace Award. If people remember what those looked like, no one does. But it's this crystal diamond shaped thing.
Yeah.
It won Best in Show for the indies on the floor.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very proud of Max.
Yeah.
And we'll have links to where you can check out the earlier version of the game on Itch. And you can wishlist the improved version, which is coming to Steam soonish.
Yes.
So that's very cool. So mm-hmm. very proud of our Max.
Yeah.
Hey, Max.
Yeah. And our pal Peter, who helped us get Glom published,
mm-hmm.
Is there testing out and pitching board games that he's representing.
Yep.
So it's sort of interesting that we have a little bit of presence within our circle on both halves of that combined convention.
Yeah.
It's I was just thinking about this. I don't want to get us off topic because this could be another entire episode. But like, I get such a boost from other people's successes.
Yeah.
Even if it's just like, yeah, he's out there doing the thing. Or like, Max got an award. It's like,
yeah.
yes. I just
yeah.
feel so excited about that.
Yeah, it's really great.
Keep doing the stuff, you guys. Okay, so I have a question for you guys to lead into this topic.
Mm-hmm.
If you could pick just one, I mean, maybe you can pick more than one. I'm not going to be super strict with this question, right? But
yeah.
if you could pick a video game character that you could be real life friends with, who would it be and why?
Kirby.
Okay, why?
Because he's cute.
That would get tired so quick.
It would just be like
the thing about friendships is you don't have to interact with them all the time. You know,
it's true.
He doesn't live with you in your apartment eating all your food.
That's not a friendship.
So that actually goes to like what I find this question very difficult because there are so many contextual questions
right.
I have the answer to. Like, do I live in that world?
Live in this world.
What use are they in this world? You know, I'm thinking
you're just friends. You don't have to have a use for your friends. They're right. just people you hang out with and you
like
them.
No. But I agree with Mark because like, think about it. If you were friends with I can't think of, not Nolan North. He exists. What's the guy he voices in Uncharted? What's his name?
That guy. Okay.
That guy. Yeah. That guy. You'd be thrust into a bunch of adventures, or you'd have to hear him talk about his adventures all the time.
So don't pick that person.
Well, okay.
Well, I guess what I mean is like, and that's the closest example of a real person you could be really friends with. Think about like Mass Effect, which I'm trying to think of characters that have a lot going for them that aren't just mascots, don't just have mechanics, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I don't like, I'm thinking about like Garrus
would be fun.
Or, you know, or any of the sort of popular characters from Mass Effect. I'm like, actually, would I enjoy hanging out with them outside the context of the adventure they're on?
Yeah.
You know?
I feel like Garrus is my boy when I'm playing Mass Effect, but also like I just feel like he'd be the kind of person where if you get him on a topic, he would just go and go and go and go and go and go
right.
and go. You'd be like, "Hey, I'll see you next week." Oh my god.
Yeah.
But still, for sure, I would definitely want to hang out with Rex.
Yeah.
I definitely want to hang out with Rex.
Have one word conversations.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rex.
So. Gosh, I really thought this would be like more of a conversation with you guys. You're like Kirby, and Mark's like no one.
I mean, I'm honestly just dodging the question. I don't have a good answer.
Yeah. You don't want to be friends with any video game characters.
I don't really. I've talked about this a little bit before, but I really engage with video games like their stories.
Yeah,
I'm not that even with the interactive component. I'm not that interested in inserting myself into them.
Interesting.
Right. Yeah. I agree with that. And also, yeah, I would imagine I would enjoy hanging out with Kirby, but just for a little while, like Mark was saying. I don't want Kirby eating all of my food.
I think that Kirby would be sick of me before I got sick of Kirby, because I would just be like, eat that. Well, what about that? What happens if you eat that?
I mean, having a living waste disposal as a pal would be kind of cool, I guess.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm thinking like, you know, my favorite, like Luigi's my favorite Mario character.
Yeah.
But like, I couldn't imagine what it would be like because there's just not enough there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not like a personality that's been fleshed out.
Right.
And some games have that and some games don't. Like May Borowski from Night in the Woods would be super cool to hang out with her for a while. Mm. She's also a little much sometimes. But and all the characters in that game, for example, are really, really well fleshed out. But that's the kind of game that is.
Right.
So that makes sense. Anyway, so I wanted to ask about this because it leads into the topic of parasocial relationships. And you will note in our little script document that I have lots and lots of notes because it turns out there's a lot less living in my head on this topic than I thought when I listed it on our list of topics that we wanted to discuss.
Okay.
So I had to do a little bit of research. And I didn't, you know, I'm not an expert by any means, but this is kind of it can lead to some hopefully interesting conversation and definitely some links for listeners to look at and read on their own time. Mm-hmm. So this idea of parasocial relationship is a theory that was, I think, developed first in the 1950s, initially relating to like television personas.
Yeah.
So it's this idea that it's a parasocial interaction where you are consuming media in a way that feels to your brain like an interpersonal interaction, but the interpersonal part is missing, right? Because there's nothing, it's one directional.
Right.
There's nothing back to the persona. It's just you consuming the persona. But your brain is so hardwired for social interaction that like it uses the same tools to interpret that information and to like carve out emotional space for these people. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm paraphrasing a lot of different sources here, but basically it's like, you've got this illusion of intimacy, friendship, and identification with this persona, but that person that's on the other side of that persona doesn't know anything about you.
Right.
So, for example, like you might feel like you know your favorite podcasters personally, and maybe you do because you know them personally. But like, if you hear a lot about their personal lives and they speak conversationally and they make jokes and so on and like so forth, you will feel like you how, like, you know them, like when you feel a familiarity when you start the podcast, when you hear their voice, when you hear something like positive in the news about them, you have like a connection to them as if they were a real friend of yours.
Right.
But they are not. So like, I feel this way about the McElroys now because I've listened to so much of their stuff and I've listened to their stuff for so long. It's like, Justin McElroy. But if I said that to Justin McElroy, if I saw him on the street, it would be like, he'd be like, this is an annoying fan.
Yeah.
He'd be probably really gracious about it. But yeah, like, we don't have a personal connection. So that's just kind of an example of what that's like.
And what's interesting about it, I think, with the rise of like Twitch streamers and that and podcasters and that more that intimate format, I think more people know about parasocial relationships than did prior, you know, in the last decade or two. But I think what's important about it, it's not a delusion.
Right.
It's not, you feel like you know them. At no point do you believe that they're your friend.
Right.
I mean, there are. That's another topic. But I think what you're describing is that feeling that is instinctual for us as social animals, not necessarily getting so carried away that like you can't tell fact from fiction or anything like that.
Right.
Even though a lot of people sort of frame the conversation in that way about these things, because it's sort of there's something kind of like mockable about it, you know. And so you can kind of like that person is crazy. Is it epithet you throw at someone for like having those feelings?
Yeah.
And it's treated a lot. I think it's treated a lot like that when it isn't really that. Like even when you're really caught up in that, you don't actually ever literally believe it.
Right. Like a well-adjusted person, a person who is socially well-adjusted and maybe even parasocially well-adjusted, because that might be a thing we got to think about these days now too. Right. You know, like, you have a good sense of personal boundaries, and that's with people that you're interacting with face to face, people who are presenting themselves as themselves online, you have a good sense of boundaries, and then also people who are presenting themselves as personas online, you have a sense of boundaries, and a well-adjusted person will be able to navigate that. Maybe well-adjusted is the wrong word, because like there are definitely some non-neurotypical conditions that make that more difficult for people. So I don't think that necessarily means that you're not well adjusted. It's just like there's a lot going on. But like, I think for the vast majority of people, those boundaries are maybe not always easy to navigate, but it's kind of a natural part of your day. It's a natural part of your social interaction.
Yeah. You listen to the same talk radio host or whatever every day on the way to work or something like that. It predates a lot of the newer media.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That familiarity is important. Like sit down and hang out with Johnny Carson for an hour before you go to bed.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way of phrasing it. It's specifically like talk shows like that.
Yeah. And the language around it from media personalities has long encouraged that kind of metaphor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you'll hear someone like a TV host say like, thank you for welcoming me into your home, like talking to all the listeners or all the viewers.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like those metaphors are so strong. And it encourages that kind of, it's not like play acting exactly, but it's that the analog to those in-person experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, like, and it's interesting. I think there's more to revisit here, and we'll come back around to it as to, like, what do you design for if you're kind of trying to create that sort of parasocial relationship?
Yeah.
Should you design for it and so on and so forth? But, like, that the person, the listener, the consumer is for sure carving out a part of their life for this persona.
Yeah.
And so I think it makes sense to like for the persona to acknowledge that in some way. I guess just to kind of flesh out the definition a little bit more, a counterexample would be, okay, your best friend from another country who plays Destiny with you every week, but you've never met in person.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's not a parasocial relationship.
No.
They're presenting themselves as a real person. You are presenting yourself as a real person. Your relationship has, you know, back and forth in both directions, and it's evolving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the both of you,
right? And I think like if you think about just like the definition of a relationship, when you have a relationship with another person, there's a, you know, a back and forth. Mm-hmm. You bring something to the table, they bring something to the table.
Mm-hmm.
In a parasocial relationship, the host or whoever, the entertainer, is bringing something to the relationship, but you're not bringing anything to their relationship aside from money, I guess, or viewership, you know? Yeah. Does that make sense?
They don't have any individual relationship with you.
Exactly.
You're just a member of the fans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically.
But I think this is very definitely true for streamers, podcasters, folks who have a presence on Patreon, for example, like us.
Yeah.
Or have a Discord or something, is that those parasocial relationships are it's not an all or nothing proposition, I think.
Yeah.
It's an imbalance, right? Mm-hmm. So like you know, we have a Discord channel that we engage with the listeners of the show on.
Right.
And those are actual conversations and actual that there is some relationship there.
Yes.
But it's very contextualized and it's very imbalanced.
Right.
Right. And so that those would be parasocial relationships as well.
Yes.
And I think that if streamers are like, oh, let's engage in chat.
Right.
Like that is they are actually engaging with their listeners. Mm-hmm. But it still doesn't escape that definition.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it can make that because there's some there, like it can make that the parasocial relationship a lot stronger. Mm-hmm. Because
right.
there's more than just someone behind a screen.
Yes.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. That's a good thing to bring up.
And that's something that like folks who are content creators and that is now part of the course for building an audience, there's a lot of things you have to be careful about. Mm-hmm. What of you are you revealing?
Right.
Right. Especially for people who make lots and lots of content, streamers particularly, who they have like hours to fill.
Yeah.
It's hard to put a wall there sometimes, and people can learn more about you just by, you know, matter of course. Mm-hmm. And so that balance is strange, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Yep. I think so. I think one thing I'm not quite sure on, and we can dig into this too as we talk a little bit more about parasocial relationships in games specifically,
yeah.
is like avatars, right? So I'm thinking specifically of, okay, well, let's just think of World of Warcraft, right? Very popular. We can talk about that. I didn't like role play when I was active in World of Warcraft. I didn't role play mm-hmm, sure. in my character, right? She yeah. was just an avatar for me. And, you know, we'd run around. I got run around and, but she didn't, I didn't create a persona for her. I didn't create a backstory for her. I didn't flesh her out as a character. She was really just representation of me in the digital world.
Yeah.
So I didn't have a parasocial relationship with her, and none of the other people I was playing with structured their characters that way. So they didn't have parasocial relationships with my character either. Mm-hmm. But I can imagine, just from doing a whole bunch of role playing with D&D that like the RP servers, if you were taking it really seriously and you did have a backstory for your character and you did have a persona that you were enacting when you were, you know, logged into the game, mm-hmm. then you could have a parasocial relationship with your character and you could have a parasocial relationship with others' characters and also simultaneously a real relationship with the people who were playing those characters. Mm. So I just wanted to bring that up because I think it's an interesting thing that happens with games that I'm not sure can happen in other media because of that. There is this agreed upon delineation between this is a character and this is the player. So that's just something that came to mind. I wanted to toss that out there. Any reactions?
It is interesting when you talk about like the relationship you have with another person's character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that is still a real relationship.
Right.
I would be hesitant to call that parasocial, even if it's fake. Right, mm-hmm. because there's still two people behind the wheels of their characters
interacting,
where the interaction is happening.
Right. Yeah,
right. But when you think about like NPC characters, like that is where you do a lot of you project relationships.
Right.
So like you know you don't want any of your Pikmin to die or whatever. You have yeah. an emotional investment in there, and that has a lot of the hallmarks of parasocial relationships in that you know you're putting a lot. And you again, you're not fooling yourself, but mm-hmm. you're feeling like there is a thing when there's no, but there's also nobody on the other side.
Yeah.
Right. So that is interesting. Like you're expanding the definition further than I would have expected.
I'm not sure if I'm expanding the definition as I am asking a question. I wrote down like, okay, here's an example of a parasocial relationship. Here's a counterexample. And here's the I'm not sure category. And that's where I put other players' personas and avatars.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I just don't know.
Well, okay, imagine you're playing D&D with a bunch of strangers and you don't get to see their faces or anything like that, but you get to, you know, they're narrating what they're doing in the game. Is that, is that a relationship with the other players or are your characters just relate, you know?
Yeah, that's the question. And that might be, I mean, this sounds like an academic discourse because like I just don't feel qualified to really make a stance on it.
Sure.
But like, yeah, I mean, like at that point, if I'm playing with strangers and I'm interacting with those characters, then yeah, I guess it's maybe more parasocial because
yeah.
I'm not interacting with the players. But on the other hand, it's not a one-way street, right? Like my choices with my character are interacting with their choices in their character in this real-time environment.
Yeah.
And so that aspect of it to me doesn't seem like a parasocial, because it is, there is two-way directionality mm-hmm. in the relationship. So, mm-hmm. and I think that's what Mark was kind of getting at.
Yeah. And it is interesting. Like the relationships that you have in your life, like at work, for example, if the place where you work is such where you are doing a lot of code switching, or you're putting on a mask, not to define it too much, or not to give it a negative connotation, but where, you know, then the relationships that you have with the people who are also doing that, mm-hmm. It is essentially both of you are creating characters.
Yeah.
So I almost think that's like a separate dimension on these things.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right? So it's like the character you're creating, whether it's in a video game, a D&D session, or at work, mm-hmm. They are having a relationship with those other characters.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Where you fit in that is another matter. It's a layer deeper, I guess.
Yeah.
Sounds extra complicated.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so now let's get into the research that I did, because there was so much. So first of all, there's this really great PDF that's out there called The Player's Parasocial Interaction with Digital Entities. And it really just goes into the definition of parasocial interaction kind of within a game context. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to paraphrase it as in like, okay, it's a one-sided social relationship between a player and a digital entity occurring as if the entity were a real person, even though the player knows it's not.
Yeah.
Right. Sure. So like, I think Gladys was one of the examples from the white paper. I think that, you know, like any of the Rex, for example, right? Or Garrus, for example, you know, these are, they're not controlled by other people. They're not controlled by you. They have a scripted preset, like universe of responses, but they're all written in a way that brings a persona to life and allows you to engage with it emotionally. Yeah, so that was really cool. I thought that was really helpful. And then they, this particular paper like breaks down a few different examples that are common in gaming of how the player interacts with the game and the personas in the game. Mm-hmm. And then it says like, okay, this is why this fits the original definition of parasocial interaction and when, why this other example doesn't. And so I think that's a really good read if you want to understand a little bit more about how those specific things can play out. The other thing that I looked into, it was actually just happy accident. I've been listening to a podcast called No Stupid Questions, mm-hmm. which is on the Freakonomics radio network. And they've got a psychologist and someone who's like well-versed in behavioral economics. And they just talk about all kinds of interesting things where those two topics intersect. And they happen to have one on parasocial relationships, like the near past. So I was just like, okay, I'm going to listen to this one that says, this one episode titled, Is It Weird for Adults to Have Imaginary Friends? And it was all about parasocial relationships. Mm-hmm. So I think that the thing that was interesting about that podcast is they finally got to the question about like, okay, is it a bad thing? You know, like, is it weird, like they said, for adults to have imaginary friends? And they were talking at this point about why it's this built-in kind of reflexive response to relationship information coming in for you to have feelings back towards the thing that's giving you that information.
Yeah. Right.
Even though you're not actually getting the live, like real feedback you'd get from a real relationship. And so, that was a really good listen. As far as, you know, thinking about the good and the bad from a psychological perspective. And Angela Duckworth, who's the psychologist who's on that podcast, she basically said, okay, if you're thinking about how useful parasocial relationships are in maintaining mental health, they may be useful if you're trying to like practice certain things by, you know, thinking through hypotheticals and so on and so forth. But she used the phrase on-ramp onto different ways of thinking. Mm-hmm. If you're using that as a replacement for socializing, that's going to be something to take a look at.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know. What other things pop out as potentially good and bad things about parasocial relationships folks?
When you brought up the imaginary friends things, I immediately thought of like how I will have imaginary arguments with my friends about certain topics.
Which friends?
I'm not going to answer that. just all of my friends, really. It's not it's not a particular person. Just because, like, I don't know, they might have brought up a topic, and then I was like, oh, I'm uneducated on this thing. But then later on, I'm like, oh, I have a better understanding of this thing. So now I'm going to beat you with facts and logic on this or whatever in my head, which, you know, is unfair.
Yeah.
Because you always win.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, sometimes I lose arguments with myself in my head. But anyway.
I'm sorry, Stephen.
No, I win too, so it works out.
Yeah.
So I'm reminded of that, but I think, like, that is me, like, practicing my new knowledge and understanding of this particular topic,
mm-hmm.
and, like, trying to better, I guess, understand what I had an issue with in the past and why I've evolved from that now. Mm-hmm. So, like, I'm imagining, especially, like, with respect to, like, imaginary friends, like, when you're a child, you're, like, practicing relationships and, like, communication and stuff with your imaginary friend.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, like, I think that principle, like, sticks with people as they grow up. It just manifests itself in a different way. Yeah. So I don't know that that has to do with parasocial relationships.
Well, I think that's close to what I got from mm-hmm. Angela Duckworth's words on that, which was like, yeah. If it's serving the same kind of a purpose that a child's imaginary friend does,
yeah.
You know, or if it's for entertainment, whatever, that's fine. But if it's a substitute for real social interaction,
yeah.
Real relationships,
yeah.
That's where it can potentially be a little dangerous. What comes to mind just from what you were saying there, Stephen, is like, sometimes if I, you know, because I have chronic depression, and so I've done a lot of work over the years to try to catch those intrusive thoughts patterns when yeah. they start getting carried away.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that one of the techniques that I use to get myself out of a pattern of thinking is, first of all, I recognize that I'm in a negative pattern of thinking. I'll be like, okay, if I said this out loud to Eric, how much would he like look at me in that way that he looks at me like, come on. and now at this point, I don't even have to have the conversation with him. I can just imagine the conversation with him, and it helps me break like negative patterns of thinking.
Yeah.
And if I need some extra help, then I'll just be like, Eric, this is what I'm thinking, and I'm imagining that you would say this. And so I'm just saying this out loud, and he'll be like, yep. And that'll be the end of the conversation, because I'll say his entire half of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that might be an example. I mean, it's not a parasocial relationship because I'm married to the guy. We have a real relationship.
Right. Yes. Right.
But like, I could imagine that kind of thing happening with like a character that I really loved.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you're both describing a mechanism that you use in parasocial relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where you imagine how your conversation would go with someone who you can't have that conversation with.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, in the both of your cases, you can have that conversation,
right.
But that's also a tool that's used when you can't.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting, Stephen, you were talking about having those imaginary conversations with people, you know, if for a purpose, right? Yeah. Like, you know, to win an argument, right? Right? Yes. Like a sort of adversarial relationship. And that's essentially a healthy mechanism so that you don't fight with your friends too much.
Yeah.
Right?
That's maybe, I know, I'm realizing I don't imagine my brother in this way.
Right, because you guys yell a lot.
Yeah.
But I think what it does is it says to me that those kind of parallel relationships are not always media based, right?
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. I think a lot about when you work in an office and the boss doesn't know you that well,
right?
Or your supervisor isn't paying a lot of attention to you, or when you're in school and there's the popular kid that you want to be friends with,
yeah.
You use those tools, but that's where you can get carried away, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think any of those kinds of things, like when you're watching a YouTube video and someone is, you know, revealing more of their personality to encourage that kind of parasocial relationship, you engaging in that isn't by itself a negative thing,
mm-hmm. right?
But that mechanism can be like all things in moderation, right?
Yes.
And so I think a lot about when I think we've all probably, especially when we were younger, you have someone who you think is your friend, but they don't think of you as your friend.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh no.
And so and that realization, then you realize what you've been doing is that you've been having this relationship that's a case where you can fool yourself, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I think when it's structured, like in media, then it's probably a little bit easier to tell fact from fiction.
Yeah.
Right. I think in the real world is where you can, if you don't recognize those mechanisms, then you can be in trouble.
Yeah.
Huh.
In certain cases.
That's interesting because I hadn't thought about it that way. Like I've been thinking about the parasocial relationships and like practicing different skills or on-ramping different ways of thinking as like very, like thinking through specific skills, like thinking through conversations or thinking through your own emotional reaction to potential situations. But what you're describing, Mark, is like parasocial relationships are a means for you to hone your imagination, period. Is almost what it sounds like, which is, I kind of like that. It's broader than I was initially thinking, and it feels right to me.
Hmm. Ah, and so to relate this back to game development.
That's where we're going next, Stephen.
Yes.
So I guess the questions I wanted to bring back to you, which is like, is this something to aim for? And if we're thinking about developing characters, does thinking about the parasocial relationships that players might have with those characters influence the way that we construct those characters?
Yeah. I will say, this is probably how I think about a lot of media. And I said up front, I tend not to project myself into something. I like being an audience member, right? Yeah. Even when it's interactive. Mm-hmm. But I do think about like fandom culture and when somebody says like Luke Skywalker wouldn't behave that way because I know Luke Skywalker really well.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And I think it's, if you're someone who's creating characters, and this is, you know, the anime is loaded with this, you know, where you have to, I think you have to be a little wary of encouraging those kinds of relationships with your audience. Either creating characters that can engender those feelings, or as a creator, as a personality, like leaning too hard into it because it's a successful marketing strategy. Mm. I think there is a lot of danger there.
Sure.
And I think about games where people get really attached to certain characters, and then that limits their imagination for what those characters can do,
right?
Because they put them in a box.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like, I've defined my relationship with that character and I feel so strongly about it because I've been encouraged though, that suddenly if they're different or they do something that I don't expect them to do, then that can be very painful in the way a friend who betrays you can feel painful. And I think that's really dangerous. And you see this from YouTubers a lot who like, they don't want to play Minecraft anymore. They want to play something else.
Yeah.
But they kind of can't. Mm-hmm. Like, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's really fascinating because it's like that, the way that you described it, in that like a person got hurt because the relationship that they thought they had established, or the understanding that they thought they had of this person, was shown to be false.
Yeah.
Can be hurtful in a way that a creator did not intend.
Right.
And I think like, yeah, if you bring it back to like streamers or, you know, content creators, you know, and they play Minecraft a lot and they all of a sudden want to play Hearthstone, it would be strange for this person, for a viewer to, you know, have established this relationship as the Minecraft expert playing this other game all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Because it's not the relationship that they wanted or cared to have or expected to have.
Right. And a lot of times you'll watch a TV show and it'll get canceled.
Right.
And that'll be a bummer.
Yes.
But like, and you're mad at the network for doing it.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But like
Netflix,
it's different because you don't have that. If it were that the characters on the show canceled the show, it would feel more like a betrayal. So that's not a metaphor that really works. Right.
Sure.
But when you think a lot about this, Star Wars is actually quite a good example of this, mm-hmm. is where like, people who think Luke Skywalker would never do that,
right?
They're not. They are. They're in their right mind, right? They're not. They're wrong, maybe, but like they're not delusional.
Yeah.
And so what they do then is they blame the writer or the director or the producer, and then they put a lot of hate on that person.
Yes.
And kind of think that they own those stories and that character, and because they have that relationship, they are free to describe the people who create those things, mm-hmm. in really negative ways, right. Even though if it weren't for them, you wouldn't have it at all. You know?
Right.
And that's the kind of cognitive dissonance you can have. And I think a lot about like Star Wars and Star Trek, like certain groups of fans will talk about like Kathleen Kennedy or Alex Kurtzman, the producers of each of those series, mm-hmm. and get really like have really personal attacks against those people.
Yeah.
Because that's because they're not going to say Luke Skywalker disappointed me.
Right.
Right. Mm. It's
yeah.
Right. Even though that's really that's what the creator is supposed to do is to say like this character will change or grow and it will and the relationship you have with them, it should be fraught and you should be like, oh, I didn't. That's part of the experiencing a narrative, experiencing fiction. But when you have that kind of relationship to something you really love, then it doesn't feel like that happened because literally that character didn't make those decisions.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you as a normal functioning non-delusional human being do have someone to blame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's why it's hard to reason with people who go really far at the deep end of those things.
Yeah.
Because it all does add up. Like their opinions don't seem, you know, delusional. They seem like it makes sense, but there's that extra layer they're not considering, like their motivations for those feelings.
Yeah.
As you were describing that, Mark, the character that immediately came to mind for me was Daenerys Targaryen in the Game of Thrones show.
Yeah.
Like this season 8, I have really bad feelings about that. even though like when I talk through it, like the character progression could make sense, but like the execution of it wasn't exactly what I wanted, like wasn't convincing and so on and so forth. So yeah, like my analytical brain is coming into conflict with like my parasocial relationship with Daenerys Stormborn.
Yeah.
And she's like, they did her dirty. But she doesn't exist.
right. Yeah.
So I think, that's really interesting. On the other hand, like the things that make a parasocial relationship happen are the things that can that you look for when you're trying to do really good character development, right? Like you've got a compelling acting or compelling writing, you've got a compelling story.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I guess one other thing to think about is like maybe this is more of an issue with television than it is with games, just because like television tells a lot of story in a shorter period of time, and because of how episodic different shows can be and how serialized movies can be, like you will see a character really develop a lot over time.
Yeah,
right.
Whereas with like a character like Samus Aran, there's probably some strong parasocial relationship trends as well, and some of the games that she's been in the franchise, which has spanned decades, have not been well received because of how that character was presented in that game. And others have been really well received because of she was especially emotive in that game, pretty wild, but like not in a way that felt like contradictory to her character. And I feel like it's like if you look at the game industry overall, like all the games ever, there aren't that many characters that span that length of time. So maybe that's one of the reasons why this is typically something that's discussed in when it comes to media as something that's with streamers or with podcasters or with fictional characters in television, because there's more meat there a lot of the time. I don't know.
Well, I think it's a lot of it is the fact that it's when you're Samus Aran, you are playing as her.
Right.
And so that relationship is a little different. In that you sort of view those stories through her eyes, and so the relationships you have are with the other characters in a game like that. I mean, Metroid's an example where there's not a lot of story all told, so there's maybe not too much to hook into. But if in television you are definitely you're not personified anywhere, so you end up forming a relationship with Walter White. And then,
oh boy.
Right. And then that's what the anti-hero trend in television. It was, a lot of writers didn't understand what kind of relationships they were forming with their audience. All the people who love Rick and Morty, and every week that show is telling you how bad that character is.
Right.
And a lot of people don't get it because there's an inherent, a desire to I have a relationship with that character, and so I have to find the good in them, or I have to root for them.
Yeah.
And, you can root for the bad guy, but, at a certain point, no amount of Rick and Morty, the television show, telling you that Rick is a terrible person that you'd never want to hang out with, but it depicts him doing cool things that you would want to hang out with. It's like, there's, I think that does happen, like you say, more in those types of media because it's, the format is designed around it in a way, and games not as much, I don't think. Which I think a lot of narrative designers might object to, because there are lots of great narrative in games. There's just not, I mean, per percentage by volume, not quite as much.
Yeah, maybe.
It's interesting you bring up great narrative in games.
Oh, really? I wonder why that is.
Because, well, we're going to do the call to action.
Yes. I have the t-shirt.
You have the t-shirt.
I have the t-shirt.
You have the t-shirt.
Did you get a t-shirt?
I do have a t-shirt.
You have a t-shirt?
I do.
And Mark has a t-shirt?
I wore mine yesterday.
Ooh. Oh,
was it soft?
It was very soft.
Did it have our logo?
It did.
Check.
On the front and the back.
And the back.
Mm-hmm.
Did you receive this as a gift?
From myself to myself.
what a thoughtful person. Have you given the t-shirt as a gift?
I got one for Dale.
Nice.
I did too. I got one for my mom.
Nice.
I was thinking about getting one for my dad because Father's Day, well, I guess would have passed by now, but.
That's a great idea.
So you need to get on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Quick making a note here. Ellen, get t-shirt for dad.
Yeah.
You can do that at nicegames.club/shirt.
Thanks for the reminder, Steven.
No problem.
Shipping should be pretty quick too.
Ooh.
So you should be all right.
Good to know. Good to know.
Ooh, okay. Good. Safe.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Speaking of narrative, we already did that transition. I'm doing.
What are we going to talk about, Steven?
Narrative pacing.
Ooh.
Basically, this is just a topic for me to complain about how games don't do this right. but I don't have a solution, so I guess y'all can write.
That's a trick you've played before, I think.
Oh, plenty of times. Plenty of times.
Isn't that why people create podcasts to begin with? Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Not this podcast specifically. We're Nice Games Club, of course. Narrative pacing, what is it? It's where you pick, you know, where you put all the cool, fun stuff, where all the cool, fun stuff goes and where all the boring exposition stuff goes. You need to put that in a way to keep the player engaged or listener or viewer or what have you engaged in the story, but not, you don't want to like pile everything in the beginning and then you just have an hour of boring nothingness because then like, why are you watching the rest of the hour, you know? So that's narrative pacing. Games don't do it right, I'm here to say.
Yeah.
And I'm guilty of this myself as a game developer. I think that games oftentimes pace themselves like they're movies. I think specifically AAA games do this, which is, I think, a problem. Because, like, you know, in a movie, you know, you're watching a movie for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and that's it. Games are, like, 10 times as long as that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult to hold that attention to the narrative that long. It's not possible.
Right.
In the same way. I think a lot of times with games too, like the people remember the big moments, like the stuff that, I mean, I guess this is the same with like with movies and stuff too, but I feel like you remember like a lot of lines and things that happen that bring you to these moments. But with video games, you just remember the big things that happened, the big things that you did or your character did in a cutscene or whatnot. And because games are so much longer than movies, you don't really, like, you can't remember what happens when, like, some big narrative thing happens. So, like, if someone's parents die, you'd be like, who are those characters again? Like, by the time that happens, because, like, I don't know, that was 10 hours ago when you were introduced to these characters.
Yeah, a lot of times a video game will fill in its time, not with more for the main character, but with more characters.
Yes.
Side characters. And so you have these thin, you have like seven thin plots that all are stretched out over 20 hours.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's very difficult to like, you, it's like you check back in on this for the next beat of their story. And then you're like, wait, what's it, what happened?
Yeah,
why,
yeah.
Why do I care? How does this relate to anything?
Yeah, actually, a lot of like games remind me of TV shows in that way. Like you'll cut, like, I mean, because TV shows are actually comparable in terms of length a lot of the time.
Yeah.
With video games. And I think that like, you know, in between seasons, you'll forget what happened to so-and-so character because, I mean, you know, it's been a, well, it's been several months. This is a bit of, it's a bit different from video games because oftentimes when you play a video game, you play it through full, but sometimes you don't. And so you'll forget what happened to these characters because like, it's, you know, it's not at the front of your mind by the time you start watching the next season or what have you, or even the next episode really. And I think that like, this is an issue that like we haven't quite figured out yet, especially since as games get longer, AAA games are, you know, getting longer than much longer than they were in the past. It becomes more and more of an issue that we haven't quite figured out. So I am here to ask us, Nice Games Club, for help because I don't know how to solve this.
Do better.
Yeah, do better, but figure it out for me. No, no.
Well, part of the problem is the interactive nature of games.
Exactly.
You know, the in a film or a television show or any kind of linear narrative, it can be like Everything Everywhere All at Once is a very long movie.
Yes.
Doesn't feel that long.
Yes.
Because it's well paced is why. And what you can do, pacing requires control over the narrative.
Yeah.
And video game developers just don't have that or have as much of that by design. And so that's another reason why you shouldn't make your game play like a movie, because like by definition you cannot achieve the same thing.
Exactly.
You know, a piece of plot, a piece of dialogue, you know, is it propels you to the next thing.
Yeah.
And in video games, you are what propels you to the next thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And so even if you do have a really great scene that does then propel the plot, you are still the one who has to do it.
Yeah.
And so the feeling is just very different.
Right.
Right. And so games can be really, really long. They can be as long as anything, right? Like a 12-hour game versus an 18-hour game can feel the same in terms of the overall arc.
Yeah.
Because there isn't that sort of propulsive plot. And that's why games, I think, can be I'm not complaining that games are too long. I do complain that games are too long. But I think that that's maybe not the problem here necessarily. It's that structurally games can't be paced the same way as in her story.
Yes.
Therefore, they can be as long as they need to be, because it doesn't make it worse the longer it gets.
Right.
Right. Once the game is more than 3 hours long, then you've broken it, and it won't get any worse if it's 20 or 30 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting solution to this, though, is to just make your game shorter. Just make it 2 hours long.
Yeah.
And then you can pace it like a movie, and it would make as much sense. But again, like you're saying, Mark, the player gets to determine how quickly they go through the game. And so it doesn't exactly solve the interactable problem. It doesn't solve that the player gets to control the pacing.
So a couple examples come to mind that might be interesting to dissect. So one of them is, for me, is Breath of the Wild, right?
Yeah.
So like, first of all, something that I think it did right was that the narrative was pretty simple and also familiar, right? Like, yeah, you're the chosen one, it's Link again, and you're gonna save the princess. So Hyrule is in danger and it's Ganon, But like, the specifics of how that story took shape in that nation / state of that world was something that you were constantly reminded of as you explored the environment. And so they did, like, they really rested upon the environmental storytelling. And let me explain a couple examples that I think bear this out. So one, like all the temples and everything, like you're interacting with the different parts of this world.
Yeah.
And that like reminded you of the different places that you were like getting power and where the power in the world came from, and that you had Koroks you could go visit at the tree.
Yeah.
You know, those little reminders were everywhere. You had dragons in the sky, and there's something you could do, and there was horses over there. Like all these constant reminders in the environment that you would just happen upon, regardless of what order you did things in. They were these patterns in the environment. And these repeating things that would come up that would remind you of parts of the story, even if you weren't engaged in like the main storyline, it was always there reminding you. You could always see that mountain in the distance.
Yeah.
You could always see the little like lizard, you know, walking around. There's a bird flying, and like you knew there was a lizard over there. You could see these things that were part of the story, even if you weren't directly interacting with them. They were there to remind you a lot, always about what what the meta narrative was.
Yeah.
The other thing was like they kept the story simple, like I mentioned, and then they did like at these tentpole moments, right, which were predictable. They did give you like the backstory. They gave you the cutscenes mm-hmm. and the story of like who Link was. It gave you the memories back.
Yeah.
And that felt really. It made sense to me as a player, even though those cutscenes weren't. They weren't like directly chronological, right? It wasn't right. like this yeah. cutscene immediately led into the next one. It wasn't like here's 2 hours of Link's life. These were scenes that were pulled from different parts of his life
yeah.
that you then got to stitch together in your head. And you got to do the work of constructing the narrative.
Well, it's not just that. I think it's the Breath of the Wild does a really good job of telling a different story than the one you are engaging in.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So when you're thinking, when you see that scene of Zelda researching the old those old foes, mm. like that's not something that's happening right now to Link.
Right.
So that you're not you are actually not part of that story, mm-hmm. and so that actually lets it tell it in a way that's more conventional. Because all you're doing is uncovering a story rather than... You are telling your own.
Yeah.
But that's separate from the main narrative of the game.
Right.
Which is why the one criticism I'd have... I mean, I have plenty, but the main criticism I have of the way Breath of the Wild did this is that toward the end, it started to be like the open world thing where like there's a big urgent crisis that you can get to whenever you want.
Yeah.
But for most of that game, that's not what it is. It's you complete one thing and then you can now do it gives you kind of a it keeps it the possibility space relatively small. These are the next three things you can do. And so it's manageable. Mm-hmm. But there's no necessity for you to do any of that now mm-hmm. because the urgency isn't there yet. Mm-hmm. It comes a little later and then I think it falls apart a bit. But that's what's nice about the story in that game is that it is not your story. In a weird way.
Yeah.
So it kind of avoids some of those pitfalls. Not all games can do that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But like you're not saving Hyrule. It's gone. It's been, you know, there's ruins everywhere. Like, and so most of the time in that game, you are just exploring and then that's your story and there's nothing in there that fights it until near the end of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, I guess I'd argue that like ultimately there's not a lot of plot mm-hmm. in Mm-mm. Breath of the Wild and that's why it's fine. And not necessarily, because I don't know that the pacing in Breath of the Wild, I guess I'd argue that the pacing in Breath of the Wild is not good, just in this in the same way that I'm arguing about most games. in that, like, you know, most of this stuff is optional, and most of this stuff, which I guess is fine, but most of this stuff is also, you know, just happens, they just happen somewhat randomly. You can stumble across all of the different places that you're supposed to go in order to get the, beat the giant temple. Thing,
big baddie of a guy.
Eventually get to Ganondorf. But you just stumble across them after some point. I think the game tells you you can go to these places and you can go to these places, but like because there's so many things that you could explore right out of the gate, you don't have to go to those places and the game intends for you to not necessarily go to those places right away. They just give you objectives as a potential goal if you're like, I don't know what to do, I'll just go where the game told me to go. So I don't know that I would say that like narratively Breath of the Wild does it right.
Mm-hmm. You're saying that they kind of sidestep the issue.
Yes.
Well, okay, so
I don't think that's. I mean, that is a solution, right? I'm looking for solutions.
Right. So. Well, yeah, that's the solution. Mm-hmm. I guess the other example I wanted to bring up, just again to dissect and see what it can tell us, is Dark Souls.
Oh gosh. Okay. So right? No.
Because there is like it almost tells you nothing.
Yes.
And the narrative is something you have to really dig for.
Yes.
And that you're creating along the way.
Yeah, that is just a collection of library books. that's what Dark Souls is.
Here's the same thing. Make a story.
It's somebody else's story.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And like Breath of the Wild and Dark Souls, they sidestep the problem.
Yes.
But it's because they're not engaging in a impossible task.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'd say Dark Souls is someone else's story, but I want to hear what you meant by that.
Well, I think that the what is interesting narratively about those games is uncovering the world.
Yeah.
Right. And so ultimately the tale of you from start to finish is not that interesting. There's not a lot of demands on that part of the story.
Right, right. The tale of you is, okay, you're the chosen undead and you're taken to the place and you just keep at it until you win.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's your story. You did it. You're the one. Good job. Yeah.
Right. And it doesn't ask the player to be impressed by that.
Right.
right?
No. You should be impressed by yourself for getting kudos.
Yeah.
Right, and that's a user story, right? That's you, the player, actually doing something.
Right.
Not necessarily the seeing it unfold in the game.
Right.
And so that gets to be its own story, and then the game kind of gets out of the way of that.
Yeah.
And then the narrative it tells is separate from that.
So we've got two solutions for you, Stephen, so far. We've got tell a simple story and use lots of environmental storytelling, and tell no story and use a lot of environmental storytelling. Well,
I think a lot of times when games do it, they ignore you. They give the player the option to ignore the narrative, or you know, it's not implemented into the game.
Yeah, there are competing motivations for players.
Yes,
and so the games that I think fall the furthest on that is like where they develop a narrative and don't make it required.
Yeah,
and then there's just no way it can be good then. Mm-hmm. Right, like that's right. Kind of a blanket statement
because it's not the point.
But I do sort of feel that way. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's not the point of why you're playing the game, and I mean that's fine because sometimes you just need an excuse for things to happen so that the game works,
yeah.
The world works, I should say. But like, it doesn't allow you to develop a narrative that is compelling for players.
Mm-hmm.
It can give you like an overall interesting message or theme, you know, which is, I mean, in its own way, cool. But it's not a narrative. It's not a story. It's not you're not telling a player that character did this and such happens and, you know, fancy stuff. I don't know. I'm not a writer. maybe that's part of the problem. I think back to like games that, you know, we worked on with Widget Satchel. Like most of the narrative is told through cutscenes that happen in between levels. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So like, and I think like in Widget Satchel, like we encourage the player to explore each level and discover new fun things about it and collect all the widgets and buy doohickeys because, you know, those are the staples.
Yeah. Of course you'd want to buy doohickeys.
Yeah, and explosions, right?
Right.
None of that stuff is in the cutscenes. The motivation for the players, I think, and I mean, I suppose listeners, correct me if I'm wrong, but the motivation for players does not have to do with the narrative for the most part, right? Actually, I take it back a little bit because, Mark, you had this brilliant idea while we were developing the game to add terminals to the game that you can discover as you're exploring.
Yeah.
So you can discover more lore as you're, you know, exploring, which, you know, that pairs things together well.
Yeah. So the way that the cutscenes of Widget Satchel work are that it's the story of the humans.
Yes.
And their story, mm-hmm. which is you as the player are causing everything
right.
that they're reacting to.
Yeah.
But you are watching their story,
mm-hmm.
and you are playing your story,
yeah.
and you're watching their story.
Yes.
And so the cutscene, Sprocket appears in none of the cutscenes,
right?
The character you play. And so that is, you'd think that would be kind of boring if you're not invested in those characters, but basically that tells the player, like they can check into this story, and it is just a linear story.
Yeah.
And then, and in between the chapters of the story, you do some stuff.
Yeah.
And so, it is essentially, it's another way of sidestepping the problem, right?
So the solutions.
Like the player's motivations are not pinned down by the cutscenes.
Yeah, yeah.
You play the game as Sprocket, but Sprocket has their own motivations that the story can, you know, hint at.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I tried really hard not to have anything contradictory in there.
Yeah, and I think that all works.
Yeah.
But I guess I'm arguing that the pacing of it, you know, you forget what characters are what by the time you get to the next level, I think.
Yeah.
In Widget Satchel.
It's also not really important for the player to remember the names of the characters.
That's true. Oh, yeah. I'm terrible at names. Gosh.
Right.
I displayed that today.
Specifically in Widget Satchel. Like,
right.
You
know, yeah.
You should because the names are fun.
Yeah.
Commander Key.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like, it's not mechanically important for you to remember that. Whereas, like, you're not like navigating through your squad menu trying to pick. Well, you're obviously going to pick Rex because why wouldn't you?
But, yeah, right. I mean, even narratively, it's not important to remember the characters' names or anything like that. But I'm saying that, like, I think that, like, it does kind of feel like happenstance. Well, Sprocket's doing things, and then also the humans are doing things,
mm-hmm.
and for the most part, the player does not have to engage with that narrative. Aside from the fact that there's literally a cutscene you have to skip.
Right. Each cutscene is its own little story, too.
Yes, yeah.
So, like, because each cutscene focuses on one of the human characters.
Yeah.
Until the very end is the outro.
Mm-hmm.
And so, basically, you could have forgotten everything of the past cutscene.
Yeah.
And the next cutscene, you will not be disadvantaged by that.
Yeah.
And so, that's because when I was thinking about what to put in the cutscenes, mm-hmm. we didn't know yet how long it would take players to complete each level.
Right.
So I made sure that we didn't demand they remember, like, you know, why Auntie is taking the elevator down when later we see Maggie deal with the malfunctions on the ship.
Yeah, yeah.
Each one, they're very short, but they have a beginning, middle, and end all their own.
That's interesting to tell, like, very, very short stories in between gameplay moments.
Yeah. Like, you'll see a cutscene, and then, like, a character will, you know, emerge into a room, and then everyone else will react, and you're like, and you were like, who is that person? Because you forgot about them? Mm-hmm. Like, that, because it's demanding something on the player.
Right.
And other games do this, but with Widget Satchel, it was a case of, like, well, if it gives the players the option how invested they want to be in it, but it doesn't punish them for whatever choice they make.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Okay.
I wonder what you think about the structure. This is kind of related, but, like, using, you know, first of all, separating moments that are highly narrative from moments that are very gameplay oriented, right? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, balancing it. And then I think this is what, you know, I would expect from a lot of games, right? You're going to be balancing it heavily on the gameplay side, and the narrative side is going to be less.
Yeah.
But it sounds like one of the issues you have with that framework is that the narrative moments aren't usually placed in satisfying or effective intervals or places.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wonder what you think about, like, the idea, I guess I'm thinking about Mass Effect a lot, so I should play it again. but, like, you would get, like, a cutscene at the beginning of the mission, and you'd understand what you're trying to do, and then you'd play, you'd drop you down, the camera would zoom back, and now you're in control, and you're going to do your mission.
Right.
And then, you know, there might be, like, a climactic or semi-climactic moment in the middle of that mission where Garrus comes back, yay! Mm-hmm. And you get a tiny little cutscene there that kind of, like, okay, you have this character back. And then you'd finish your mission, you complete the objective, and then you might have another cutscene at the end. It's kind of like a really little reward for the gameplay part.
Right.
And you're not getting huge, like, galaxy shattering narrative in those pieces. It's a lot tighter than that. It's more about the interactions between the characters in that scene. But you are getting it does tie back into the overall story, and you are in control of when it happens, but it's also happening at kind of these predictive moments in the mission, right? It does train you that it's going to happen at the beginning, it might happen in the middle, it's going to happen at the end.
Right. It's an effective use of formula, because a lot of times the narrative of the game, the plot of a game, will interfere with the user story.
Yeah.
And I think the Mass Effect does a pretty good job of, like, just teaching you its format and then sticking to it. Like, that does seem kind of, like, maybe damning with faint praise, but if you're going to be interrupted in the middle of a mission with a cutscene, it is nice if you are expected to be interrupted around that time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it can surprise you in certain ways, but it doesn't feel like 3 seconds into the cutscene, you're like, oh, I get why this is here.
Yeah.
And I think one of the example I think that does that very badly, I think, is Hollow Knight.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It was just every time I came across some plot, I was not expecting it and I didn't want it.
Yeah.
And every time I was really interested in the plot, I was just lost in the levels and didn't know where to go.
Yeah.
And so it was perpetually unsatisfying in that way.
Yeah.
Which is kind of weird, because that game does have a lot of lore. Mm-hmm. But opinions vary. I'm not making a definitive statement here, but, like, I really thought it did that very poorly.
You know, that's interesting, because one of the things that I think happens, maybe this is just something that 3D games are able to do better, or just have for some reason done better. But there are, like, certain affordances in the environment that tell you, like, there is a cutscene coming up.
Yeah.
You know, like, when's the last time you played a Final Fantasy game and you didn't know there was a cutscene through that door? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, yeah.
And I can think of, like, 2D games, even, like, Metroid Dread, where I was surprised at some moments when there was a cutscene.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, like, yeah, I knew there was a door. I'm leaving this part of the screen, and it's that kind of door where I'm changing rooms. But, like, it wasn't clear that I was going to change into a room that had a boss in it.
Right.
And that's fine. I think that's not actually, like, that's fine for that game, because that game was about surprising you and making you react in the moment. But it does make me think about how that could be another tool to help control some of that pacing, right?
Yeah.
And because it is control without control. You're still putting the player in control of the pacing, mm-hmm. but you are also creating this pattern of communicating when things are going to be changing and when things are going to be happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we try to pace games just in general. Like, we try to place the players in engagement with the game in general.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm trying to argue that we should do that with narratives better. And I think, you know, we're making attempts at that. I think that the way you talked about how Mass Effect does a level does make more sense, does seem better to me. I mean, I fell off of Mass Effect by Mass Effect 2, but I did like the first Mass Effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, like, a lot of times, yeah, there will be, like, a standalone narrative that maybe ties back into the overarching narrative that helps players, like, it helped me understand what the heck was going on when I would come back to the game, because it's just, it's such a long game. Just the first one is so long.
Mm.
They get longer, right?
Yeah.
So having those little things come back to the core of what you're trying to do, I think helps. Helps players remember things as they're playing through it.
Yeah.
I mean, oftentimes now games have, like, a big old section in their UI or whatever that tells you that you can read through all of the different lore bits that you found. And they'll have, like, a journal. It's like, I did this today, I did this today. And I think that, like, helps you remember things too, but it's like, it's a lot of reading just to get back into where you were before.
Hmm.
I don't think that's a great solution either. It is the solution, but,
you know, I think the interesting thing about video games, especially ones with lots of optional side missions, is that the what we think of as pacing isn't quite what we expect. Like, if you finish a mission and then it's like, here are two places you could go to continue the main story. And games increasingly will identify main story quests versus side quests.
Yep.
So just to leave there no confusion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how I feel about that. Mm-hmm. But or you can go off and do 100 other missions. But if you do 100 other missions, that doesn't really ruin the pacing of the overall story necessarily.
Yeah.
It certainly can. Mm-hmm. But I think of it a lot like, you're watching a 2-hour movie and you're 10 minutes in and you pause it and then you go eat dinner.
Sure.
And then you start it again and you get through another 40 minutes of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's 11 o'clock. So you pause it and then you go to sleep.
Yeah.
And then you watch the last 20 minutes of it 3 weeks later.
Yeah.
You can still look at that and think that movie is pretty well paced. Like,
huh.
Right? Like, you can think of it as a whole piece, even though you experienced it with interruptions.
Yeah, okay.
And games have that. And so that alone isn't necessarily a problem.
Right.
It's just a matter of, like, motivating the player to continue on. And then when they look back on that plot, do they feel the same way about that they would about a movie they paused 10 times over the course of 3 weeks?
Okay.
That's a good
way of framing it, because that's true. Like, if you were to watch, when we talk about Star Wars, I guess, if you were to watch Star Wars and you split halfway through and then watch the other half in 2 weeks, I guess I would argue that the movie didn't hold your attention well enough to keep you engaged long enough to continue to watch it, even though you retired.
Well, I'm imagining scenarios that you had no control over.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Okay.
I would totally stay up late and watch the rest of the
movie. I mean, I would too, but...
Right.
What I mean, it's not really a problem.
Yeah. Okay,
like, you can watch half a movie and then forget to watch the other half.
Yes.
And then remember, and then, like, weeks later, and, like, maybe you forgot a couple of things or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but you kind of give... You don't think that's a problem. I guess my point is that... Pacing is less a function of time than we assume.
Okay. Mm. Yes. I think that's true. I would agree with that statement.
It's about it's things being motivated. So you go from one scene to the next scene. Are you motivated to check out? You have three plot lines intersecting in a movie.
Right.
How you cut between them depends on, like, what information was in the scene you were just in. Does that make you ask a question in your head about another one of the plot lines?
Mm-hmm.
And then the movie cuts to that plot line, and then you're satisfied because that was on your mind.
Yeah.
Games work the same way.
Yeah.
You just get to control the order in which you do all the things.
Right.
But the gameplay designer, the narrative designer, has a lot of the same kind of agency to guide your motivations.
Yes, absolutely.
And then you can just circumvent it all you want. You can play, go to the in-game bar and play in-game darts.
Yeah.
For a bunch of, for weeks just to build up your fake currency.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can continue on the side mission or the main story. And that doesn't really ruin the pacing.
Right.
Because you're still, you know what I mean?
So
it's, I mean, I sort of started off by talking about how dangerous it is when these open-ended spaces that you can fill with any game content.
Mm-hmm.
But also at the same time, that doesn't really preclude you from having a tightly paced main story.
Yes. That feels like you're arguing against what my whole position was for this whole time.
Well, what I mean to say is that there's no formula.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, okay. So then we're in agreement.
Well, it's like movies that are long but feel breezy, or movies that are 90 minutes and just like you're like, you know, yawning the whole time. Mm-hmm. It just has nothing to do with the time.
Yeah.
It sounds like maybe, yeah, instead of thinking about time between cutscenes, maybe it's thinking about the attention kind of as currency, you know? Like, because if, yeah, I'm not sure how to, like, maybe there's an existing system that lets you kind of map this a bit. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if there's a way to think about, like, the attention that a player is spending on gameplay versus narrative. And how you could map that to like the story of your game. I think I've mentioned like Kurt Vonnegut's Shapes of Stories before on the podcast, and I'm envisioning something like the shape, you know, you take the shape of the story that you're going to tell in your game, and then you like can break it up at different points and figure out like, okay, it's at this part of the story where we're going to have lots of this gameplay. And then, you know, it might help you kind of map out the tug for the player's attention between things that you are making as explicit, like narrative tent poles that require a lot of attention to make sense of, and then like lots of gameplay that require the player's attention to execute. Maybe that's a way to do it that's like more process oriented rather than like, here's an example of a game that we think did it well.
Yeah
If you can, I mean, if you can tell your story with your game mechanics, then you're just way ahead of the curve on this.
Yes,
that's a huge challenge and you're not always going to be great at it. But I think it all just comes down to the motivation to go do the next thing, either mechanically or narratively. If you go off on a million side quests, but as long as that motivation is still in your head to go back to it, great. But if the longer you go off on doing something else and that motivation fades away, then the pacing starts to suffer as a result of that.
Yeah. That might be something that comes up in playtesting too, right? Like if you watch for that and you're like, okay, people are taking a lot of time away from the, you know, away from this on the side quests, maybe I need to find a better, like a way to ramp them back up when they're ready to come back.
I don't mean to make it irresistible so you'll only stay away for so long.
Yeah.
I mean, you can stay away as long as you want. And when you decide to go back, you still feel the way you felt when it was presented to you.
Yes, yeah. We are agreeing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No solutions today. That's fine. It's not our job.
Sorry, Steven. We didn't solve your problem.
I didn't anticipate us solving the problem, but I'm glad we had a good conversation about it.
Yeah.
Just let the players do what they want, man.
Yeah.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Twitter, @nicegamesclub, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and doing push-ups. We like hearing from you, so tweet back or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Game Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. If you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. That's it for this week. So until next time, remember to
play nice
and make nice.